Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of December 3rd, 2010. The foreclosure story just goes on and on and on and on and on, kind of like the foreclosures themselves. But one family is fighting back using a familiar weapon, red tape. We'll have that story in a moment. And if you've been wondering how to fix the mess that is Wall Street, here's some sage advice.
If each investor would just wake up and look after his or her own financial interests, the system would get fixed because people would move the money in the intelligent places, which are highly diversified, very low-cost funds, and look long-term.
We'll have a conversation with the inventor of the index fund. And a self-confessed serial returner says taking stuff back is like an awkward breakup.
They say at the store, you know, what's the reason? And I say, it just didn't work out for me.
We'll have those stories coming up. But first, imagine your most frustrating customer service experience. You spend hours tearing your hair out to no avail. Well, multiply that several times over, and you've got today's foreclosure process. It's gotten so bad that this week the controller of the currency directed banks to stop putting homeowners through foreclosure proceedings while they're trying to get a loan modification. And courts are cracking down on lenders who can't produce the documents to show they own title to these homes. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports on what seems like some measure of revenge for browbeaten borrowers.
Benji, be nice.
Yvonne Alvarez lives in a six-bedroom, three-story house in Corona, Queens with her parents, her son, his wife, her siblings, and their children. All told, 13 people live in the house.
As you can see, the big living room, the kitchen. Sorry, kid. So this is her room.
What's going on? Sorry for the mess.
Hi.
The Alvarez family has lived in this house for nearly 4 years. For most of that time, they've been facing foreclosure.
Since October of 2008, and we're still fighting.
You call it a fight?
I call it more of a war.
Yvonne's father, Luis, bought the $600,000 home towards the end of the housing boom, no money down. His mortgage was a classic subprime, adjustable rate with a high minimum interest rate, and a piggyback loan, a second mortgage, with an even higher interest rate. Six members of the household contributed to the mortgage payments. But when Luis Alvarez had a stroke and couldn't work as an ambulance driver anymore, the family fell behind. Luis put his daughter Yvonne in charge of dealing with the bank to try and save the house.
It has been a nightmare. Paper after paper after paper after paper. And every month it's the same story. We didn't get the papers, we didn't get the papers, we didn't get the papers, we didn't get the papers. I've given my life up for this.
Yvonne says she spent countless hours talking to loan servicers and getting documents like pay stubs organized, notarized, and sent off. She says every time she called, she had to deal with a different person.
Tracy didn't give me the papers. Daniel isn't working here anymore. Alan? We don't have an Alan.
It didn't help that the loan kept changing hands. A unit of General Electric sold the loan to Bank of America, which handed it over to a servicer, Litton. Litton was participating in a federal program encouraging companies to modify loans rather than foreclose. Yvonne enlisted the help of attorney Sarah Manah with South Brooklyn Legal Services. Manah says even with the federal program, papers had to be submitted again and again.
More than 200 pages of documents in support of the Alvarez's loan modification application. And finally, after 10 months, they said that they had everything that they needed.
This spring, the Alvarezes were approved for trial modification. Their payments dropped from more than $4,600 a month to a manageable $2,200. But a few months later, the Alvarez's loan was passed to a new servicer, PennyMac, a company that specializes in distressed mortgages. Sarah Manah says PennyMac told her Luis Alvarez didn't qualify for a loan modification.
The new servicer told us it doesn't matter how many pages of documents you submitted to Litton or how closely they reviewed the file. We need to figure out how to help Mr. Alvarez sell his home. And basically, that was the opportunity that they were offering.
The next thing the Alvarezes knew, their house was up for sale by PennyMac. They called lawyer Sarah Manah in a panic, and she learned that PennyMac had set a date for auction. The middle of last month, Manah went to court to halt the process. She argued PennyMac hadn't provided the paperwork showing other options had been tried before foreclosure. The case is on hold because the lender has asked for time to get its papers in order. Yvonne Alvarez says she feels like the tables have finally turned.
Now they're asking for time to get the papers together. I go, oh, now the shoe is on the other foot. Now they're the ones asking for time.
PennyMac didn't comment specifically on the case, but says it's committed to helping distressed borrowers and has a high success rate modifying loans for people who qualify. Mortgage companies are under new pressure from regulators and courts to produce a document trail for every foreclosure, which isn't always so easy because of possible mistakes by companies that created the loans and companies that sold them to investors, says Columbia University housing expert Chris Mayer.
This all goes back to the fact that these were badly done at every step of the way. The originators, all they wanted to do was process loans. So they did them as fast as possible. And the underwriters, all they wanted to do was process them into mortgage-backed securities. And they did them as fast as possible. Everyone cut corners at every step of the way.
If banks can't produce the proper paperwork, it's getting tougher to foreclose, even if homeowners haven't made a mortgage payment in months. Yvonne Alvarez hopes the new scrutiny of documents will help her family stay in their home. She says she'll keep pushing the mortgage company.
I have all these people counting on me. The way I see it, you want more papers? Fine. I'll give you an office full of papers if that's what you want. But we're staying there. We'll fight it till the end.
In Corona, Queens, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace Money.
Rumors abounded this week that Google will pay more than $5 billion for Groupon. That's one of the biggest online daily deal pushers, offering coupons for things like spas and restaurants and experiences. We asked Marketplace's Jennifer Collins to sample as many of those deals as she could in a week, which is when she discovered the Groupon conundrum.
This is me. Most nights after work, I curl up with a good book, play a game of solitaire.
Yes, I won again.
Enjoy a little light viewing.
Tonight on Frontline, Breaking the Bank.
This is me on Groupon, hanging on for dear life to the mechanical bull at Saddle Ranch Chop House. I dragged a couple of girlfriends along to help with my research.
We'll be cheering you on, so whenever you feel like you're ready.
Just in case you missed out on the Groupon craze, here's how it works. The company sends you an email every day offering a half-price deal at a local store or restaurant. If enough people buy in, everyone gets the deal. For Saddle Ranch, I brought along two half-price Groupons. That would have given us $60 to spend on our apple pecan salad, our Mai Tais.
Along with the monster platter of appetizers. Ideal for two or more hungry ranchers.
Thing is, the restaurant would only take one Groupon per table, and that left me with a tab of $30, which brings me to Groupon lesson number one. Don't actually try to use your Groupon with a group. Maybe I'll have better luck with my next deal.
My name is John Huntington, and I own Long Beach Hydro Bikes.
Hydro Bikes are like mini catamarans with pedals. Huntington rents them out by the hour, and when he offered half-price rentals earlier this year on Groupon, he was swamped. And it's not hard to see why.
Oh my goodness, did you see that pelican?
Wildlife. Whoa, he's eating a bird.
Problem was, Huntington only had 7 bikes at the time. That brings us to Groupon lesson number 2. Just because you buy it doesn't mean you can use it anytime soon. You may have to wait weeks for a reservation. Joseph Priester teaches marketing at the University of Southern California. He says people often jump on these deals simply because they're, well, deals.
So it seems really good, but then when you actually get to the nuts and bolts of executing it, it might actually be difficult to ever find a time that you could redeem the coupon before it expires.
I'm still sitting on an Ethiopian dinner, a cooking class, not to mention the Groupon leftover from Saddle Ranch. I'm so stressed out by trying to use all my Groupons, I'm going to need a Groupon for therapy. So now, Groupon lesson number 3. It can cost a lot to save money on Groupon. Take my next adventure. I spent $25 on gas and 3 hours in traffic so that I could take advantage of a half-priced Segway rental. You know Segways, those two-wheeled things favored by mall cops.
I'm on a Segway in Long Beach. Pretty much the funniest thing anybody has ever seen.
Joseph Priester says we should put a value on all those hours we spend on Groupon.
So the real consumption is time. And if you end up spending those minutes trying to do something that you wouldn't have normally done because you saved $30, I think that's where it can get pernicious.
So does that mean I shouldn't take advantage of that deal I just saw, the 60% off spray tan? Looking very pale in Los Angeles, I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace Money.
The President's Deficit Commission released its report this week. Among the recommendations, raise the retirement age for Social Security benefits. Of course, some lucky folks can retire even earlier. Maybe they saved more aggressively or have a pension that kicks in before they turn 65. But commentator Sydney Legere found a different path to early retirement.
Like many little girls, I dreamed of growing up to be an actress. I grew up to be an accountant. Like many grown-ups, I dreamed of retiring early. I did do that 3 years ago at the age of 44. If you share the dream of early retirement, you're going to have to save more money more quickly than someone who retires at 65. Of course, you'll need to max out on your 401k contributions and make sure you get that employer match. There's a lot of other advice out there on how to save even more money. Give up your cable TV, stop dining out, and forego that daily latte. Sure, that'll save a few bucks, and those few bucks will add up over the years. But if you really want to supercharge your retirement savings, think big. Don't have kids. Not convinced? Think about this. The cost of raising and educating the requisite 2.3 kids here in the San Francisco Bay Area would have set me back nearly $1 million. I know, the Bay Area is not the cheapest place to raise kids, but no matter where you live, it's going to cost a small fortune. And these figures only include the actual costs, like feeding and educating the kids. They don't include the hit to household income when one parent decides to give up a career to be home with the kids. Nor do they include what's known as the motherhood premium, the drop in salary experienced by university-educated women after having a child. Yes, if you decide to give up the joys of parenthood for a life of leisure, you won't have those kids to rely on when you're old and decrepit. But that's not even the worst part. If you choose this path, prepare yourself now. Because while you may be happy with this decision, most everyone else will try and convince you that you shouldn't be.
Sydney Legere writes a blog called Retirement, a Full-Time Job. Post your thoughts on our Facebook page or go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. When anyone tells you they know what's happening on the stock market, here is one phrase to keep in mind. Don't count on it.
Basically, trying to ignore these short-term fluctuations in the market, which, as I've often said, are like a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
The founder of Vanguard talks about his new book titled Don't Count on It. That's coming up later on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Figland, and it's that time in the show where we take questions from you. And I'm helped this week, once again, by MSN columnist Liz Pilliam-Weston. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Tess.
Have you recovered from Turkey Day?
Oh, I'm still rolling around here. I think it's going to take a few weeks.
Well, unfortunately, a few weeks is all you have to figure out the tax situation.
Oh.
And, you know, I got to tell you, I don't know how this thing is going to be resolved by the end of the year. And that's got to make tax accountants just tear their hair out at this point.
They're
and the
going
rest
crazy.
Of us.
Yeah, exactly. I was talking to my accountant trying to figure out, okay, what do we do to wrap up year end and get ready for next year?
Right.
And because there's no decision on whether the Bush tax cuts are going to expire or be extended, he couldn't offer me any advice. You know, normally the advice would be you push off income into next year and you accelerate deductions into this year.
Right.
Well, this year, if the tax cuts expired, you might want to do the
opposite.
Yeah, exactly. So you might want to, you know, accelerate the income and push off the deductions. And they just don't know because no decision has been made about whether these tax cuts are going to expire or be extended. I'd still say, you know, talk to your accountant so
right.
you can work out some kind of plan. But, you know, we might not have a resolution of this, you know, before the end of the year. I hope we do.
Has there been any patch to the AMT this year, the alternative minimum tax that they've been patching every year for the last several years?
That's another thing that's set to expire.
Wow.
So it's one of those things where they really have to, I mean, I think they really have to settle down and fix this thing, but they've been patching and patching and
right.
patching rather than actually come up with a real solution.
What a complete mess.
Yes.
Well, with that in mind, let's turn to the phones. And our first caller is Gina, and she's in Marina Del Rey, California. Hi, Gina.
Hi, Tess. How are you?
We're doing well. We've just been talking about this whole tax situation. Have you figured yours out?
Oh, no, I haven't, but I'm scared too.
Yeah, I know. I think we all are.
Yeah.
I have to ask you, you have a wonderful accent. Where are you from?
Originally from Mexico City.
Uh-huh.
And I went to school in England, so I'm guessing that's why you're asking.
Well, it's wonderful. It's fun to listen to. So what do you do there in Marina Del Rey?
I am a psychologist.
Can you put Uncle Sam on the couch and tell us what on earth is going on in Washington?
Trust me, if that happened, everything would go back to normal.
She could cure him. Oh, that would be so wonderful.
Yeah,
you know, we need you.
Definitely needs a little therapy going on there.
Yeah. So do you have any sort of, you know, just snap diagnosis of what's happening there?
Oh, my goodness. So I would say antisocial. Truly. And then other things seem pretty bipolar to me.
So. Yes, yes, yes. I'd have to agree with
and
that.
And some personality disorders thrown in there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you have to throw it in there somewhere.
Well, so how can we help diagnose your money situation? What's your question?
Okay. Well, this is the deal. My private practice, I opened basically a few months ago, and because of you know, the economy and all the things that are going on, I haven't been able to really fully realize where I thought I was going to be right now. So I thought, you know, I opened the credit cards and I started using them, and in my mind was like, it's okay, because, you know, when I get licensed, open my private practice will be very soon, then everything will go back to normal, right? Well, no.
Okay.
It's not happening that way. Long story short, I'm in debt, which I had never been in my whole life.
How much are we talking about?
Around a 30.
$30,000?
Yes.
Have you called your credit card companies to talk to them about this?
Well, you know, I was going to, but the first call I made was to this debt relief thing that came in the mail. So now I realize there's different types of debt relief agencies.
Uh-oh. Red lights going off all over the place, Liz.
Uh-huh.
You know, Liz, this is something that, frankly, anyone who watches television knows exactly what we're talking about here. Let's see if this sounds familiar to everyone.
We help good people improve tough money problems.
As a result of today's economic crisis, banks are willing to accept significantly less than you owe.
Debt Doctors has the prescription allowing you to sleep better tonight. Stop harassing phone calls, threatening letters today.
Yeah, so those messages sound familiar to you?
Yeah, totally.
Liz, you know, we talked about red lights going off here. How do you know when one of these debt relief companies is legit and when it's not?
Well, that's the tough part of it. I mean, there have been new regulations put into place that are supposed to kind of shake out the bad guys, but it's really tough to know. And my first question is, did you pay this company a fee?
Yes, well, I did. I did
you
send
did.
Them one, like the initial, you know, subscription fee or whatever.
How much was that?
150 or so.
Okay. Well, you're not too far in, which is great.
No,
I mean,
no.
The problem with a lot of these places is they demanded the huge upfront fees, and you know, they demanded to be paid before you started even saving money for the creditors and all that.
No, this doesn't work that way. They sent me a page in which I would open a fund in my name, put in a previously agreed upon amount for a period of several months. Then the fee is eventually paid to the credit cards at a negotiated lower, you know, kind of 75% to 50% off by what he said.
Now, were you sending the money to them or are you putting it aside yourself?
No, I actually, yeah, they're taking it out of my account. I gave them my information. And so,
Okay. Well, the problem with a lot of these debt resolution companies is that they're playing on confusion because there are a lot of different approaches that you can take to debt. One of them, and the one I recommend first, is to contact a legitimate credit counselor. They have debt management programs that could allow you to pay your debt off over, say, 5 years at a reduced interest rate. So that would be the first appointment I would make, is go talk to one. They're affiliated with the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, nfcc.org. I would also make an appointment with a bankruptcy attorney, because the problem with the credit counseling folks is they're not going to tell you if bankruptcy might be a better option for you. And a lot of times by the time people realize they're in trouble, they're in too deep to get out. So talking to a bankruptcy attorney about your options is something that's very important. Most people who are in debt trouble who can get relief through a Chapter 7 bankruptcy that wipes out the debt, probably going to be better off going that way. If you can't file for bankruptcy, Chapter 7, for whatever reason, your income's too high or there's some other, you're trying to protect some property or something like that, only then does debt settlement start to make sense. Now, the problem with debt settlement is you're trying to settle your debts for less than what you owe, but you're opening yourself up to lawsuits, mm-hmm. continued harassment by collectors.
Yeah.
And a lot of these programs simply fail.
Well, you know, in all fairness, they have been really good about it because I was in shock and not mm-hmm. communicating with them, trying to figure out what to do, I had already called and said, stop everything. And they called me a couple of other times. And eventually I called back, and that's when, you know, he kind of convinced me again that it would be a good way to do it, that bankruptcy was horrible, that you really have a very hard time. You're not able to buy anything for like 10 years.
Well, and let's not sugarcoat it. Bankruptcy is not fun, and it's not a good thing to have happen to you.
No.
It will affect, you know, at least the next 10 years of your life.
Yes, that's what he was saying, yeah.
But so does debt settlement. That's right. The other part of the story is, you know, you're going to trash your credit either way. If you do not pay your bills, your credit's going to suffer. The thing with bankruptcy is it puts a button on it. Right. You know, you wipe the debt out,
yeah.
you get a fresh start. With debt settlement, maybe not so much. You know, the unpaid debt could be sold to another collector. This could go on and on and on. So the problem, I think, is that a lot of people who are getting into trouble for the first time, you know, are trying to avoid bankruptcy. And the problem I see over and over again is they're struggling with unpayable debt and they don't realize it. So they keep throwing good money after bad. And what I really don't want to see is you draining your retirement account or, you know, yeah. I see people draining their home equity. I see people draining their retirement accounts. Those things could be protected in bankruptcy. So that's what bankruptcy offers, is a fresh start to just clear the plate and start over.
Right. Okay.
Okay, Gina, does that help you out?
Yes, absolutely. It's wonderful.
All right, Gina, best of luck to you. Let us know how it goes.
Thank you so much. I will.
All right. Next up, we have Stuart in Chicago. Hi, Stuart.
Hello. How are you doing?
We're doing well. You know, the show was just in Chicago a few months ago. Should we have knocked on your door and said hello?
Actually, I just moved in yesterday.
Oh, well, so you would not have been there. Where did you move from?
I moved from Cincinnati, Ohio, really from Covington, Kentucky, which is just across the river.
Oh, okay. Well, I bet you're finding a few things different about Chicago, the weather for one.
Yes, they don't call it the Windy City for nothing.
Yeah, that's for sure. And the cost of living, I would think, is a little different there, too.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that's actually part of my question, but I'll get to that here in a moment.
Okay. Why did you move?
I got a promotion, and my company sent me to Chicago.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, so it sounds like, boy, you got a promotion. You moved to the big city. How can we help you out?
Well, I essentially have two choices, and I needed a little bit of help figuring out which is going to be the best for me.
All right, hit us.
Last year, I hit my goal, and I'm going to get my first bonus check I've ever gotten in my life. I have a small amount of debt, and I'm curious as to whether it would be more beneficial for me to settle those accounts and try to pay off only a percentage on those accounts, try to save myself some money right now, and maybe possibly take a hit on my credit score, or to pay the full amount and potentially help out my credit score.
How much debt are we talking about?
About $3,000.
Oh. And what's the bonus amount?
After taxes, it's going to be approximately $8,400.
Okay. Well, let me ask you a bit of a tough love question. Why should you not have to pay the debts that you incurred?
Well, there is no particular reason. I just know that settling is an option. Another thing on top of that is, since I am living in a much more expensive city, I would take whatever was left over from my bonus check and essentially create an emergency fund.
Well, Liz, I think you know where I'm going with this.
But I actually have a different perspective. So
you do?
Yes.
All right.
Surprisingly.
Well, let me tell you, you know, I've done a lot of interviews with people who are in serious credit card debt. And in fact, I did a series a couple of years ago of folks who were in Debtors Anonymous. And one of the things that one of them told me that has always stuck out for me was that when you put something on a credit card, you have not paid for it. So my question is why you should not have to pay for that. Liz, would you like to answer that?
Well, I'll tell you what. Where are the debts now? I need to know, are they with the original creditors? Are they in collections? Where do they stand?
Yes. So approximately $2,000 of it is just on the credit card, still with the credit card company.
Okay.
And $1,000 of it is in collections. However, they're not being aggressive or anything because I am making monthly payments on that currently.
Oh, you're making monthly payments on the one that's in collections?
I'm making monthly payments on both, but the collections company is being pretty flexible and working well with me so far.
Okay. Well, I would say obviously pay off the $2,000 that's with the current creditor right now. The thing is that the amount that's already in collections, once the debt goes to collections, and I'm not talking about the collections department within the credit card company, but they've actually sold it to a collections agency.
Right.
Once that's happened, you aren't going to do your credit any good by paying it off. Once it's in collections, it's kind of done the damage. Also, when they sell it to the collections company, they tend to sell it for much less than the face value. So sometimes negotiating to settle it is a perfectly legitimate approach. Now, Tess would say, and I totally understand, you got the money, you might as well pay it. You can still have a lot of money left over to build up that emergency fund so you don't get in debt again.
Which is a great idea. We are fully supportive of the emergency
fund. Totally there.
Well, I got that idea from you guys originally.
All right. I like to hear
that. The message is getting through. So what do you think, Stuart?
The sense that I'm getting, at least in doing some quick math here, is that I will go ahead and pay off the credit card in full and probably try to do a little bit of haggling with the collections company. And I certainly do appreciate your guys' help.
All right. Well, best of luck with the adjustment there in Chicago. I went to school there. I think you're going to love that city. It's an awesome city.
I'm loving it so far.
Well, best of luck.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
All right, well, let's go to our final caller, and Ryan is with us from Bermuda Dunes, California. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Where is Bermuda Dunes?
It's about 15 miles east of Palm Springs.
Oh, okay. Do you actually have dunes out there?
We did.
Yeah.
But they paved them over and put in parking lots.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's
price of progress.
Sad.
Paradise.
Right.
Put up a parking lot.
Exactly. Exactly.
Liz, would you like to take the microphone now. And perform for us?
Just channeling a little 60s angst.
Right, right. So what do you do out there in Bermuda Dunes?
I'm a project analyst for an HMO.
Ah, healthcare.
Yeah.
You know, we just did a whole show about that. Insurance companies are not always well-liked, are they?
No.
Yeah.
No, it's a problem with family function sometimes.
Now, do you think it's understandable? I mean, you're on the other side of that equation. You know, your customers don't particularly love you, but are they being inordinately harsh?
I don't think they're being inordinately harsh. I do kind of understand a lot of the problems that people have with it. I mean, it's a really complicated system. I mean, I've been doing it for a couple of years, and I am just starting to understand some of it.
Yeah. Well, on to your particular reason for calling us today. How's your money management?
Okay. Well, basically, my question is, I have a 4 to 6 month emergency fund that is sitting there.
All right.
Yeah.
We're going to do a virtual pat on the back for you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. My question, though, is it's earning about 1%, and I would rather that it earned a little more than 1%.
Yeah, wouldn't we all?
Yeah.
And I use a website called mint.com to kind of manage all of my finances,
yep.
And one of the things that they do is have advertisements on there, and one of the advertisements they had was for a website called lendingclub.com.
Uh-huh,
and
yep.
I was doing a little bit of research into it, and I know it's not risk-free, but I'm trying to figure out, is it worth the risk to go into something like that?
Yeah, Liz, first of all, let's talk about lendingclub.com, and it's certainly not the only one out there. This is what's called peer-to-peer lending,
mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like microfinance for borrowers here in the U.S. Is this safe? Is it a good idea? Do you indeed get a better return than you would on your average savings account? Well, I think you would get a better return pretty much anywhere aside from your average savings account. But
yeah, here's the thing. I mean, Lending Club is actually not sort of a feel-good, you know, nonprofit kind of thing. It is about lending money to people for a return. So it's a business proposition. But there is a risk of loss. You know, there are people that don't pay. There are people that, you know, are lying about their situations or whatever.
Yeah.
I've talked to people that have made money, but there is that risk of loss. And the thing about an emergency fund is you want it there in case of emergency.
Right.
You don't want that money working for you. You want it sitting in a rocking chair waiting for you when you need it. So sad news is if that's what the money is for, it needs to be in an FDIC-insured bank account. Earning 1% or less, you know.
Completely liquid.
Okay.
Completely liquid and completely accessible. So
all right.
Ryan, I'm sorry. I mean, I know, I understand the impulse. It's really frustrating. But the good news is there isn't that much inflation going on. So you're not really losing much ground.
Yeah, okay.
So what do you think, Ryan?
Oh, it's not the answer I wanted to hear, but it's a good answer. So I guess I'll just keep my money earning 1%.
Yeah. And hey, it's safe.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. If you've got a question, do let us know about it. Our voicemail is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. Or send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Liz Pulliam-Weston, great as always to have you on. It's been fun.
My pleasure.
And do remember to talk to your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. Black Friday is finally in the rearview mirror, and while lots of shoppers will fill the malls over the next few weekends, the next big retail day is the 26th. On the upside, all those gift cards being redeemed, but on the downside, all those returns of things that were not on Santa's list. The National Retail Federation says last year close to 10% of all holiday purchases were returned. Now, we know reasons for returning stuff can vary, but what about the more chronic group of shoppers who just can't seem to hang on to their purchases?
My name is Eleanor Brody, and I live in Framingham, Massachusetts. I don't shop a lot, but whenever I do, I usually buy several items, several shirts, several skirts or pants, and almost always with the intention of returning some of them because I'd like to take them home, look at myself in my home mirror, look in my closet to make sure that, yes, I do have something that I can wear, some shirt that goes with these pants and this skirt and so forth. And so I almost always return something. Of course, I would never wear anything or use any item and then return it. That's totally dishonest and just not something I would do. My husband sees me bring things home and spread them all out and decide and look in front of the mirror and check to see what goes with what. And when he goes into a store, he sees what he wants and buys it. When I buy things for him, I'll buy much more than I know we're going to keep. There have been times when I've bought things and whoops, he likes them all. And my intention was to take some back, but if they please him, then we just go with it. Well, they say at the store, you know, what's the reason? And I say, it just didn't work out for me. Most women that I've talked with, that's just part of their process of shopping. You buy something, bring it home, doesn't work, back to the store. And yes, it's time consuming, but I do it. People do online shopping, which I do occasionally, but only for things that I know I'm not going to have to return, because returning things that you've bought online is a pain. I do not abuse the system. There are people who do. And actually, in that case, I don't feel sorry for the retailer, but I understand why the retailer would put the kibosh on that kind of behavior.
Of course, we all know people who seem to love to return things. Can't decide on a Christmas gift for a friend? Buy four, return three. Shopping and taking it back can be a time-consuming habit, but a mostly pretty harmless one. Except when it crosses the line into a serious problem. We asked Dr. Timothy Fong for some insight. He's an associate professor of psychiatry at UCLA and does all kinds of research on addictive behavior.
This is a brand new area of compulsive shopping that we're starting to see. And these are folks who are consumed with the process of returning items, whereas for a long time we saw a lot of compulsive shoppers consumed by the process of getting the item. Yeah. We're starting to see more folks just really concerned about just returning the item.
You know, we just heard from someone on the show who said that she almost always buys things with the intention of returning some of them. Now, is there anything wrong with that?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. I mean, the way I think about all addictions is that they are behaviors that create harm and people continue to do it. Now, if you think about this, what is the, quote, harm created by compulsively returning things? Well, it can be, you know, quite significant if it's things like loss of time, loss of productivity, loss of money to the retail stores. But in the patients that I've seen, there's always been problems with significant others or spouses and arguments centered around the shopping and the returning of items. Essentially, that behavior takes on a life of its own, and it dominates their thought and their time to the point where all sorts of other harmful things have happened in the functioning.
So do you think this is, can be classified as an addiction?
We don't have the research yet out there. I think it's signs of addictive disorders, but with compulsive shopping, or in this case, compulsive returning, you don't see anyone, quote, overdosing from returning items, or you don't see people, you know, killing themselves or things like that.
But I hope not.
No, what we do see, and I've seen, is people suffering.
This is different, isn't it, from the folks who buy an item with the intention of using it once or twice and then returning it to the store. That's just fraud, isn't it?
That's certainly one way to look at it. I think of compulsive shopping as the overarching disorder. And within that, we have different flavors of it. One of them is returning or returnaholic. So again, the classic compulsive shopper, it's the process of shopping that's drawing them in. And within that process of shopping is returning items. So there are some patients I have who are just consumed about getting the item. And there are other patients who I have that are just consumed about returning it to get, quote, the perfect value. It's kind of like gamblers, and you think about people with gambling addiction who keep playing for, quote, the perfect hand or the jackpot, and they're just always in the hunt for something that's essentially unattainable.
Is it possible to say then at what point you have a problem?
That's the sort of research we're trying to do. The way I do it in the clinic is very simply, does your behavior contribute to the overall quality of your life, or does it take away from it? Now, for instance, I have some family members and friends who are bargain hunters, and they love returning items. And when they see it go on sale, they go back and they stand in line and get their $5 or $10 worth of merchandise, and they love it. Then there are the stories of my patients, though, who are constantly returning items, neglecting their housework, neglecting their relationships with their family, neglecting their jobs, calling in sick, and being so consumed about searching for the right item or getting the right value of it that they neglect all those other aspects of their lives. What I'm fascinated about is some of our retail policies of where you can return items even though it was purchased years ago. It's fascinating to me how tolerant our retail association has been about purchasing items. And I think that also has to be looked at as well. Because I remember as a kid growing up, if you bought something, you lived by your choice. And you didn't have an opportunity to return it. And you had to deal with it.
All right. Dr. Timothy Fong is an associate professor of psychiatry at UCLA and director of their addiction medicine clinic. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
We asked reporter Janet Babin in New York to look into some of those return policies Professor Fong mentioned. And she joins us now. Hi, Janet.
Hey, Tess.
So I know you're going to talk about specific store policies in your story, but, you know, it seems to me the retail industry must lose quite a bit of money from all this returning. How does it hurt them?
Well, they do lose a lot of money because you figure to get those items back on the shelf when people are returning goods, you have to employ people. But those people aren't taking in any more money. They're just, you know, putting stuff back on the shelf that these retailers are going to have to sell again. And a lot of times they can't sell it at their store again. So they have to figure out some secondary market to send it to. You know, I talked to Sarah Loveland about returns at her small business. She co-owns Daddy's Board Shop in Portland, Oregon. It's a family-run business. And it sells skateboards and snowboards.
It's really hard on the small business. Somebody returns something that I can't turn around and sell as new.
The board shop only takes back unused gear, but Loveland says that doesn't stop parents from trying to return their kids' used skateboards.
That kind of disturbs me because I know that their child knows that they're lying and they're trying to essentially shoplift, in my definition.
Retailers will lose almost $14 billion this year on returns. That's up close to a third over 2009. Joseph LaRocca with the National Retail Federation, says some stores have installed new policies to curb returns.
You find many now requiring a receipt. You might find there's some time limits, 30 days or 60 days. And many retailers now are giving out gift receipts.
Some stores don't even like to discuss their return policies. They refer customers to the fine print on the receipt. Saks Fifth Avenue limits returns to within 30 days of purchase. And to be fully credited, a customer must have a receipt. Compare that to Nordstrom's policy. Here's Nordstrom spokesman Colin Johnson.
We don't actually have a formal policy regarding returns at Nordstrom. We evaluate each situation on a case-by-case basis.
How does Nordstrom deal with serial returners?
We don't really view it that way. Look, we sincerely hope to provide good service.
Nordstrom doesn't require a receipt for returns, nor does Bed Bath & Beyond. Compare that to electronics chains that require a restocking fee of up to 25%. Instead of tightening returns policies that can turn off consumers, most big retailers have gone high-tech. They track every return we make. Jim Bunn with retail consulting firm Clear Thinking Group tells stores to create an in-house database of all customer returns.
They'll look at it in two ways. You have people that are returning a lot, or you have people who are trying to do fraudulent things.
Return rates vary depending on what you buy. Book publishers have to take back up to 30% of their sales. For clothing, the average is between 6 and 8%. Retailers can only do so much to contain buyer's remorse. Bunn recommends that stores offer customers a discount if they buy something else when they come in to make the return.
When you come into the store and return something, you can get a coupon for use in the store that day.
That new purchase helps offset losses, but nothing will eliminate returns altogether. Fickle shoppers are just part of the cost of doing business. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace Money.
One thing a lot of people wish they could return, all the lousy investment choices they've made this year. Whether you panicked and sold when you should have held or stayed with something way past its prime, investing is not for the faint of heart. If you think you know what you're doing, don't count on it. And appropriately enough, that is the title of the latest book from Jack Bogle, the inventor of the index fund and founder of Vanguard. Jack, welcome back to the show. And let me start by asking you, what are we not supposed to count on?
Well, you're not supposed to count on the fact that the past will be prologue to the future, number one. The past doesn't tell us very much about the stock market, and indeed, there's a great deal of evidence. The past totally misleads you because often the things that have done best in the past will follow with a period where they do worse.
Well, if past is not prologue, then how should we be thinking about future stock market performance? How do we plan to invest for the future?
Well, investing is a risky business, but I think the first thing we do is think about our asset allocation, how much we want to have in bonds and how much in stocks. And, you know, I like to think of it, rule of thumb, when you retire, that your bond position equaling your age, because you've got more money at stake, you've got less time to recoup, and you're going to start to need income. Stocks don't provide it, and bonds do. Now, in terms of the stock market itself, to me, investing is owning corporations and getting the earnings growth that should parallel our economy over time.
You mentioned in the book that years ago, when you were a younger man, your senior thesis dealt with the psychology of investing, which, of course, is all the rage these days. You suggested that experts like portfolio managers would be leading the direction of the market based on evaluation of the performance of a company's value, not the average person's opinion of the value of a share. Why do you think you were wrong?
Oh, my goodness, how wrong I was. You know, Lord Keynes, John Maynard Keynes, the great British economist, said that that's just what would happen, that the institutions would follow the individuals. And I said, no, institutions will be much brighter. They'll invest and not speculate. What happened is that we became, I think we financial institutions, followers rather than leaders, because the focus became a very short-term focus in stock market. As I've often said, we have a rent-a-stock business, not an own-a-stock industry. These institutions aren't really investing money for the people that have entrusted to them. They're agents, and they're putting their own interests first before the interest of the principals that they're obliged to serve first, and they aren't doing that. Back when I wrote that thesis, believe this or not, these financial institutions owned 8% of all the stock in the stock market, and now they own 70%.
Well, if we are surrounded by speculators, by short-term stock renters, why should we have any of our money anywhere but under the mattress?
Well, the one guarantee you will have, you put under the mattress for the next 40 years, each dollar you save will still have that same dollar look about it, but it'll probably be worth about 20 cents because of inflation.
Yeah.
So the question is, where can you earn the kind of return that you want? It is in intermediate term bonds. The yields can be in the 4 to 4.5% range. And in the stock market, you should be able to get, with risk, I want to underscore, something like a 7% return. If you're able to average 5% on your total portfolio, you know, your money will double in 14 years. It'll redouble in 28 years, and so on out.
But even if you are long-term, how can you be in a market that is so filled with these short-time renters, with people like Bernie Madoff, with companies that, you know, end up causing the kind of flash crash that we had in May? You don't have any control over so much of it.
Well, you know, the fact that in the flash crash, the market dropped, I think, 500 points or something in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
You don't have to act on that. It's basically trying to ignore these short-term fluctuations in the market, which, as I've often said, quoting Shakespeare here, are like a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
You also talk quite a bit in the book about fixing the way that people invest. You say money managers need to be better, but also that, you know, the individual investor has to be more well-informed. What's the best way to get yourself to that point?
There are two solutions to this mess we're in. One, if each investor would just wake up and look after his or her own financial interests, the system would get fixed because people would move the money in the intelligent places, which are highly diversified, very low-cost funds, and look long-term. Now, that's going to take a long time to happen. So what I've recommended, if we want a more global solution, quicker, and that is to have a federal statute that says these investment institutions must put the interest of their clients first before anything else. Costs would come down, investment would take over speculation, and these giant institutions would then tell our corporations in this country, you better get well managed or we're going to change the board of directors and the management.
John Bogle, thanks so much for speaking with us. It's been a pleasure as always.
Okay, Tess, good to be with you.
And you can read an excerpt of the book at our webpage dedicated to all things literary. It's called The Big Book and has more book selections and author interviews. That's at marketplace.org/thebigbook. That is Marketplace Money for this week. You know, folks, Father Time is marching toward 2011, so we want to hear what the new year is going to mean for your wallet, bank account, retirement fund. Resolutions, my friends, financial resolutions. Tell us about yours on our Facebook page or at marketplace.org. Next time, remember that cooking pan you just had to get because the recipe wouldn't be the same without it?
I bought this in 2000. And I thought I was a Food Network chef, so that's why I bought it.
And never used it. Been there, done that. We'll attend a class on buyer's remorse. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We will see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering advisors and clients a range of retirement savings solutions. Is a Roth IRA conversion right for you? You can talk to your advisor and evaluate your options at rothirablog.com.
American Public Media.